gracious me.
Doctor, I'm in trouble. Doctor, I'm in trouble.
Go.
Always believe in yourself. It helps to be mad. What was the Dean Karnazes quote, dude?
Eating pizza.
If you eat a pizza, you get touched by God. Was that it? But if you do ultra marathons, you get some chili on top. I know the quote that Al was talking about. Just can't remember it. Everyone quotes it, don't they?
We're going to have to start this again, aren't we?
No way, man. This is it.
Our banter is so bad. Boris is opening the nightclubs, mate.
Is he? But the way you've just said that, I sort of envisaged that Boris was personally going to open them all. I could just see him kind of doing... Do you remember Peter Kay? He did a series of John Smith's adverts. Do you remember them?
No Nonsense or proper Nonsense or
No Nonsense.
Yeah. No Nonsense, that was it.
He did the Olympic diving ad and he does the bommy. It's a 10 out of 10. I could just imagine Boris kind of reshooting all of those. He's just Peter Kay and a half, isn't he?
Or Boris doing a stage dive.
What a muppet. Oh, get us out of this slow hole. Oh, my God.
Have you seen the timeline that's done by a four-year-old?
In crayons.
So at the start, it's got a T-Rex.
Yeah.
And then there's 67 million years until mankind.
Yeah.
And that's about halfway. And then there's the rest of the timeline to the 21st of June. Is fucking ages.
Oh, mate, you know that date's going to slide, isn't it? We all know it's going to slide.
I'm desperate for a barber. I'm getting porridge stuck in my beard and I feel
mate,
like
you need
caveman.
To do a DIY job. It'd be hilarious.
I can't. It'll just end up all patchy. It's...
You know all the kids, they do like live Instagram things. Let's do a Camino live. Just purely you shaving your beard into some kind of shape.
For charity?
No, suck charity. Let's just do it for ourselves. No one's going to watch. Eric, everyone that watches, we're going to plant a tree, okay? If 10 people watch, we're going to drink a bottle of Al's personally made whiskey, English whiskey.
Oh, drink the bottle of whiskey whilst I shave my beard.
Whilst you're shaving your beard. There must be some beard named bottles of whiskey. It goes hand in glove, doesn't it?
Jura whiskey. Sort of goes with climbers, doesn't it? From the 70s. It's like a bit of the sort of thing that Chris Bonington would drink on the north face of Everest.
Whiskey in your tea.
Whiskey in your tea. Tenzing.
Tenzing.
Tenzing Sherpa. Do you know, I watched that the other night, actually. Have you watched Everest, the movie where it all goes wrong?
This has nothing to do with Windows.
It's nothing to do with selling conservatories, no, in the 80s. I bet you
I'm
tried
sure
that.
I've seen that one. I'm not sure.
You've not seen it?
Yeah.
It's a fascinating movie, actually. You should look at it and think about it in the context of coaching and that kind of stuff. So it's essentially a sort of morality tale on what goes wrong. When you've got people who are professionals who are really, really good at what they do, so in this case climbers, and they are taking people who are definitely not professionals but still, you know, kind of experienced climbers, but essentially the amateurs are paying the professionals to guide them up Everest. And that was quite a recent kind of thing that I guess it started in the early, well, mid-90s. A guy called Rob Hall, Kiwi guy, and he started up a company called Adventure Consultants, where him and a handful of other professional climbers would guide amateurs up big peaks, not just Everest, but Seven Summits, various other climbs. And essentially, it was a pretty successful business. But in 1996, it all went horrifically wrong. That's what that movie is about. It's about how it goes wrong and what happens to them and the mistakes that were made and the bad luck that they had. And yeah, it's fascinating and tragic at the same time.
Mate, there's a lot of interesting parallels here, aren't there? I mean, we are infamously going to attempt the Bob Graham round.
Yes.
And obviously, big news in the Bob Graham round in the last year or so was the organisers stamping down on the same type of thing in the running world. So, you know, the fact that you could be living in a city and find on the web professional runners from the lakes who at the time were guiding you to around, and you could pretty much do it as a half decent runner, as a relatively competent runner, but no recces, no navigation. Yeah. It totally reliant upon the skills of other people, couldn't you? They've kind of clamped down on that. So, mate, we talk about a little bit of this with our podcast guest today, the wonderful Al Higgins, because we sort of tease him a little bit about his coach, the incredible Camille Heron. And interestingly, he first started working with Camille when he was injured. And therefore, you know, obviously the first set of training would have been clearly very focused around coming back from injury. And he talks about how there was obviously a very, in some respects, as a sort of conservative approach to the training block. So he'd been a lot more familiar with crazy miles, 150, 200 miles. And I was really fascinated about risk taking. What kind of risks do you need to take to, you know, he's a top 10 finisher of Spartathlon. How does he kind of blow things up and think about winning? And so in some respects, taking risks, Daz, you got to do some crazy stuff, haven't you? That can ultimately end in trouble in so many levels. So, you know, where do you draw the line in terms of working with other parties that are going to push you perhaps on a risk to your health, you know, risk.
Yeah,
to...
well, exactly. I mean, that Everest film is like the ultimate sort of example or kind of assessment of what you've just said. So they've got this. I mean, obviously, you know, their life goal or their dream, their ambition is to get to the summit of Everest, which is, you know, it's obviously not something that very many people on this earth manage. What's pretty clear is that that's only actually getting to the summit is just a small chunk of the challenge. Like, you got to get back down, and getting back down getting back down is a lot harder than it is to make it. And the reason that this thing goes completely as pear-shaped as it does is that they break the rules that they've set. Right. So they've set themselves a sort of risk boundary of when they make their summit attempt. They've got a turnaround time, and the turnaround time is set by the expedition leader. And he says that no one will deviate from the turnaround time, including me. You know, all you guys, if I tell you to turn around, you turn around. There's no debate. Even if you're 100 feet from the summit, if I turn you around, that's it. You're done. And that turns out not to happen. They break that rule, and he breaks his own rule, I guess. And it's tragic, because the reason he breaks the rule is very much a very human kind of goal related bit of emotion at the heart of it, which is that one of the climbers was turned around the previous year within sight of the summit, and this time round that climber is again in sight of the summit past the turnaround time, and the team leader tries to turn him around, and the guy, he wants to make that goal at all costs. You know, he's completely, that's the goal. He has to do it. And the team leader says, I'm going to break the rule and I'm going to let you do it. And they miss the turnaround, and subsequently they can't get back down partly because of exhaustion from the summit attempts, and partly because some really bad weather arrives. But yeah, it's quite incredible really how, is that way that we set goals and what we're willing to risk, what we're willing to hold on to when those things are close. It's really, really interesting. And I don't think, like, in the world of ultra, it's quite a sort of safe environment, actually, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, if you don't make your goal, well, probably not such a big deal. In mountaineering, there's lives that are on the line. And
it's deeply fascinating, though, isn't it? For us as ultra runners, you do choose to make one race your goal, and it quite often can be an overseas race, isn't it? So it's a big part of your year. Logistically, it's a lot of time out, it's a lot of expense. Therefore, to set some goals within it, that, as Al points out, you know, you mess those goals up and you sort of undermine everything that could potentially be sort of healthy mind-wise as well as physical-wise.
Yeah.
It's a dangerous game to play, isn't it? To kind of put yourself at that limit where you walk away feeling pretty disgruntled. Obviously, you said you're not dead. But
you're not dead, which is always a bonus. So.
It's always a Billy bonus. But, you know, like I said, you articulate it beautifully, Dad, where you sort of say potentially if you've got three or four aims within that race, if perhaps you aim for the lower end one, yeah, you're typically more likely to come away semi-happy, aren't you? I kind of hit that aim. I got near the summit. I did more than what most people do. It's not quite the same as getting your top 20 or hitting your PB, but yeah, you risked less.
I think what's interesting about this stuff, and maybe one of the reasons why the COVID pandemic has been so hard for everyone, is that we create identities, don't we, out of the sort of things that we want to go and do, whether it's running races or, I don't know, playing the violin in a concert or whatever it is. We create sort of identities for ourselves of how we want to live our lives. And, you know, and then hopefully we're able to go and do those things and achieve those goals or at least make an attempt towards those goals. That reinforces the kind of things that we want to do and the sorts of people that we want to be and the identities that we want to build. And when we can't do those things, I think we all find it collectively really, really difficult, which I think is why there's, you know, in the running world, we keep talking about when can we race again? People are desperate. People are desperate to get out there and kind of do those races and test themselves against those goals that they set, because that's how people build their lives and their identities as people. And that's just crucial. I think we're all desperate for that kind of thing.
Absolutely. Hopefully soon we'll start to be talking about actual races and speaking to our podcast guests who've been lucky enough to realise some of these goals very much in the vein of Senor Higgins.
Absolutely. Let's put Mr. Higgins on.
Get him on, buddy. Welcome to episode 5 of the Legends of Running Endurance podcast, friend and legend Al Higgins. Hey, Al.
Hey, how you doing? Cali Mera.
How are you today, good. Buddy?
Yeah, I'm great. The sun is shining in Dublin. It's a nice sort of spring sort of day. Yeah, good.
Beautiful. You been out for your run yet, my friend?
Yeah, first one of the day, yeah.
It's a double day, is it?
A double day today, yeah.
Excellent.
It's all easy stuff, though, no worries.
Cool. Al, I wanted to ask you about your coach. How's your coach, my friend?
Good, yeah. We've never actually met, believe it or not. It's all done over WhatsApp and then the occasional, well, kind of pretty rare phone call. So WhatsApp and email. And it's going well. It's just been a really solid, like, you know, with everything that's happening at the moment, pandemic and stuff, it's just solid training all the way. So what more can you do?
Now you're teasing the audience. You've not actually mentioned who your coach is.
Oh yeah, sorry, Camille Hare and Connor Holt. I suppose mostly Camille, but Connor's a pretty amazing coach himself. So yeah.
Al, I think it's pretty fair to say you've been doing a lot of things right in terms of ultra running. And, you know, there's a lot of stuff that we're going to dig into in the podcast. But what has working with Camille brought to the table for you, buddy? You know, what have you kind of tinkered with? What have you enjoyed trying differently?
Yeah, I suppose it's mainly the kind of same that anyone who hasn't worked with a coach finds when they start working with a coach, is that they're told to slow down. They're told to keep it consistent and not to kind of get over yourself, not to go gung ho just because you wake up one morning and you feel particularly amazing. Because when I started with Camille, I was injured. I had a pretty nasty Achilles injury, and it was probably counterintuitive starting with a coach while you're injured, but it was actually the best thing I did, because we built up really slowly, you know, essentially going from 4K runs at the easiest of easy paces, you know, barely a jog, up to proper mileage again. A few things that happened that I was kind of relieved about, because up until that sort of time, I'd been doing crazy, crazy mile training weeks. You know, you're talking like 150 to 200 miles in 1 week.
Oh, wow.
That was for my first Spartathlon. That's what I was doing in preparation for that. And it was too much. It was giving me sort of the potential of burning out, and that sort of classic scenario when you see a lot of really high mileage ultra runners they kind of reach a peak and then they just drop off and they disappear off the map. It's, it kind of happens with quite a lot of American runners, I think, who are just really into sort of that macho sort of, yeah, you know, I'm going to slam it every week. I'm going to really kind of punish the pavement and do crazy mileage. So for me, it was a relief getting the training plans once I was fit again. I was just like, is that it? You know, right, 100 miles. This is good. I've got more free time and I feel great. I'm, you know, able to sleep a bit more and stuff.
Yeah.
So it's not in any way, there's no magic bullet with her training or anything. It's, you know, you do the work, keep it consistent, you'll do well. Even the actual speed sessions and things like that, they're not particularly strenuous or they're not going to cause you sort of injury issues or anything like that.
I mean, I'm personally a huge admirer of Camille.
Yeah.
I was very lucky, Al, to be over in Albi for the World Championships. I mean, it was just like watching an athlete in a completely different race.
Yeah. Obviously, I was following the race. I've yet to have a good 24-hour race myself, but I think there's a lot I sort of took away from her performance on that day mentally more than anything else,
yeah,
because
yeah,
she really, really went through the grinder, you know, in that one.
Exactly.
And, that's you know, the mark of a champion, you know, someone who can really have so many setbacks in a race and come back from it all faster than ever. You know, she was running faster at the end, I think, than she did throughout the whole race. You know, yeah. Pretty amazing.
It's really interesting, Al. Darren and I were having a chat before, you know, we joined the call with you, and I was royally blowing some smoke up your arse, Al. I was saying, one of the many great things about Al is that he, more than many runners that I know, you know, he does have that self-control. I obsess about your Strava runs, my friend.
All right.
I've watched a lot of them, and I've always thought that, you know, one of the things that Camille is well recognized for is perhaps she, you know, she'll run a lot of really exceptional, I'd say, medium-sized training runs, so nothing more than 20 miles.
Yeah.
And as you said, so you've highlighted one thing, which is, you know, how many brilliant ultra runners genuinely are in that 150 200 mile camp. That's insane, you know. And
yeah,
Darren and I, Darren's called this out on many times, there's not many runners that can really do it.
No, you have to kind of ask yourself, what is there to be gained from back-to-back 50k training runs and things like that.
Al, are you not like, I mean, I'm still a bit worried that you're training for 24 hours or Spartathlon, that if no training run is greater than 20 miles, sort of psychologically, you think, is something going to go wrong between 20 and this enormous target of 150 miles?
Yeah, I get what you're saying. And I think if I was going into a 100 mile race, having not done many ultras, and if I was going into a 24-hour race having not done many ultras, then that would certainly be there at the back of my mind. But having done that and realizing what it takes, it is all in the head. You know, at the end of the day, if you've got your fitness and you've done consistent miles in training week after week after week, but not anything that's going to really blow your legs, you know, and screw up your quads or anything like that, I think as long as you have the mental awareness of what it's going to take, that whole thing of realizing what, you know, 15 hours into a 24-hour race, how you're going to feel at that point, rather than that gung-ho three hours into a race where you think you're Superman.
How did you make the transition, Al, from kind of a shorter distance stuff into ultras? Like, were you doing halves and marathons back in sort of 2011, 2012 kind of thing?
Yeah, I got into running because I'd hurt my knee in a bike accident, and I wasn't really into fitness or kind of working out or anything like that. Cycling was just a way of getting from A to B. But after 6 months or so, it wasn't healing properly, and I'd done a bit of physio, but the physio was like, you have to start running, just put some proper pressure on it, get it on the pavement. And so that was it. You know, from the start, it was like, okay, I've done 5k, let's do 10k then. Half marathon, maybe I could do that. And then as soon as I'd done my first marathon, I was thinking to myself, I have to do ultra marathons, because everyone does marathons.
Yeah,
there are no bragging rights for a marathon.
Marathons are too hard.
Oh, well, that's another thing. You know, when you are, yeah, definitely when you're wanting to do good times, improve your PBs, half marathons for me are the worst. Like, and marathons and 50Ks are hard enough.
Brutal, aren't they?
Horrible, horrible distance. Because, you know, you get into your head that it's just a marathon with a bit extra, but it's not. It's a lot worse.
Yeah.
But I suppose I was inspired after reading Scott Jurek's book, Eat and Run. And I'm not a vegan. I'm not into, well, I'm into eating healthily, but I was more impressed by his description of what happens in his head when he's running these crazy distances and doing bad water. And of course, he talks about his performances in the Spartathlon in that book. And I read that and I thought, there's no way in hell that I'm going to be able to go to Spartathlon and even run that race, let alone compete it. But it just goes to show, you know, little increments of improvement here and there. And eventually you get to the start line there.
Yeah, that's wonderful. So would you say that was reading that book the thing that kind of made you sort of fall in love with that concept of long distance running?
Yeah, the idea of it, because he's very kind of soulful person, I suppose. He really talks about his sort of mental process through a race, and it was quite an enlightening sort of read. What's the famous Dean Karnazes quote about marathons versus ultras versus 100 miles? I can't remember what it is, but
I don't know that one.
It's something about, you know, if you want to talk to God, run a marathon. If you want to, I can't remember what it is. It's one of these. We'll look it up.
We'll look it up. Yeah.
Google it in a minute. But it is, yeah, it kind of describes that sort of feeling when you are 12 hours into a race and the shit's hit the fan and it's just you against pitch black sky and uphill road. That's where it's at. That's the kind of, that's why we all do it, to get into that pain cave, but get through it at the same time.
Were you looking for that out, or did you discover it, you know, that kind of more deeper meditative sort of spiritual thing that we've all found in, you know, extreme distance running?
Yeah, I think I was more looking for the runner's high, which is more of a thing what you get from marathons. Like my first marathon was, that sort of feeling of crossing the line. I think it's the same for anyone who does a marathon. But yeah, maybe it's a bit like doing hard drugs, and like once you've had a little dose, you want more. It's like the little dose doesn't do it anymore.
This podcast is on dangerous grounds now, Al.
Yeah, well,
it's just gone into the explicit category. But actually, we should talk about this, because so I'm actually really, really fascinated by this concept of that sort of crossover between what you just mentioned, Al, and the ultra world. And I think there's a lot of people who make that crossover as well from having kind of certain addiction problems and find solace.
Oh, I should add that I've never had a drug problem.
we'll come on to your whiskey
yeah,
problem.
Yeah, maybe a whiskey problem. Yeah, but are a lot of misfits and a lot of people who've used running to get through the problems, whatever they are. And I think it makes it quite an interesting scene to be part of, because you could be running next to someone who nearly died from an overdose, and then the next person could be someone who nearly died from an eating disorder and whatnot. And it's good to see so many people using running in a positive way. I'm not one of these people who has one of these incredible sort of look how I changed my life stories.
Yeah.
But a lot of people have that.
Yeah. What I find fascinating as well is that to think about distance running, you said you were chasing the runner's high. And so I guess there's clearly parallels between what happens to our sort of brain chemicals or our brain composition or whatever during distance running as happens when people consume other substances. Yeah, I don't know where I'm going with that. It's just, it's quite an odd concept to think about that you can get the same thing off two such very different activities.
Yeah, and I'd love to know what's actually floating through my brain that, you know, that stage that I talked about, the darkest hour of an ultra marathon, when you don't have the runner's high and you're really struggling. It's an interesting one.
Do you sort of have that concept, Al, of the level of pain in which you believe you're willing to put your body through? I mean, you know, you clearly are exceptional, talented owl. You know, you've achieved great performances. Are they done with you at the limit? Or how do you assess what else is inside of owl, that final gear, but may translate into something pretty ugly and in the hurt locker? Mm.
That's a really difficult question, but a good one. I kind of looking back at the previous Spartathlon 2019, I thought I was pushing as hard as I could, and I thought I was really, really finished, you know, towards the finish in that last section, the last, what is it, 30 kilometers or whatever, where you're just up and down hills, and it just never seems to end. That's what gets me on the course. So at that point, I thought I was done, and I was just hanging on to get to the finish. And then I get passed by a car with Darren. You were there, weren't you, in the car? Passed me?
I think so.
Yeah, towards the finish. Russell Tullett and a few other people, and they said, yeah, the guy behind you is catching you. You better start running. And yeah, I was able to run, and I was running like at close to marathon pace at the end of Spartathlon. So that goes to show that there is always something there extra, I think, and it's a question of tapping into it. And I think Camille's very good at that kind of thing, where however she finds it, I don't know how she does, but she's able to step up a gear when everything seems to be, you know, it seems to be over. And I don't have an answer to that, because I don't know how to find it other than someone telling me that you're going to lose the place you've fought so hard to get. I can't find it myself. I think at that stage, I need someone else to tell me do it.
What was the goal in 2019 at Spartathlon? Can you remember what you'd set for yourself?
I always go into races with maybe three goals, maybe even four for Spartathlon, because there's the added incentive of finishing top British runner. So that's obviously a goal to aim for no matter what. I wanted to finish top 10 again. So that was
top 10
my
again,
main sort of objective. And then I was like thinking, well, top 5 would be amazing. But I mean, looking at the starters, I was thinking there's no chance of that. But you know yourself, there's so many things that can happen during the race where people do fall by the wayside. My main goal was pretty much the same as 2018, where it was top 20, if I can.
I find it fascinating how there are people who can hold on to their goals really well, even really deep into an ultra. And there are people who will, and I'm definitely one of the latter, who will gravitate towards the sort of minimum goal. So in Spartathlon, a lot of people gravitate towards 36 hours because it's the cutoff time. I remember from your 2018 run, you'd said top 10, and that was a sort of mantra that you were using.
That got me over the mountain.
and it was amazing because you kept saying to yourself top 10, and you finished 10th. So you get gravitating towards that goal. I find that fascinating.
There is the flip side to that, though. If your goals are unrealistic and you realize 2/3 into a race, halfway into a race, that you're not going to achieve those goals, then you have to have a plan B or a next best case scenario. I think looking at certainly the male American runners that come to Spartathlon, I think a lot of them come there thinking that they're going to blitz it. They're going to, they're going to win it, or they're going to be podium and it's going to be easy. And I think looking at the course itself and the terrain and everything, you could look at that course and say, yeah, it's not that bad, you know. But maybe they come to Spartathlon and they haven't had a plan B or a sort of fallback plan for when it does go wrong. Because it's going to go wrong at some point, several times.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Just to sort of like segue into this same area, Darren and I spoke to Michael Stocks a couple of
weeks.
Absolutely loved chatting to Mike. And I think one of the penny drops with Mike is that he's perhaps leaving very few of the things unattended, you know, like to chance, as Darren was pointing out in terms of the A goals. So I mean, he's using professional coaches for things like visualization. And I was just wondering, for someone that's achieved so much, how do you find those extra bits, Al, for from top 10 to podium? You know, what are the marginal gain opportunities as you see them for a race like Spartathlon?
That's something I maybe haven't figured out myself wholly, you know. I do, like, in my training runs, I try and visualize whatever my goal is and think about that pretty much in every run. You know, every run I do these days, I'm thinking about Spartathlon in some way. Or, you know, if I'm doing that particularly hard session, maybe it's like a hill repeat session or something, I'll think at some point during that, like, just remember this when you're running Spartathlon, remember you did this. And that can be something to fall back on. But I approach things quite simply. You know, I don't have a huge checklist of things I need to do before a race. I try and keep it simple. But I mean, last time out in 2019 at Spartathlon, I did get to the start line and I thought to myself, I'm not ready for this. I haven't mentally prepared. So I had to creep off into the bushes and just sit down for a while, get my head together, because I realized that I got to the start line and I hadn't really thought about how tough it was going to be. Visualization of the pain and the battle, you know, the things you're going to have to get through in a race, as well as, you know, finishing and as well as doing well, you know, you have to think about those things and how you're going to get through them.
Al, am I right in thinking, are you still a big fan of the old Nike shoes?
I am, yeah. At the end of the day, they're just shoes, you know. I'm actually more of a fan of the shoe I use in training, which is just, I think I've been using them for about 4 years now, the Zoom Fly.
Zoom Fly, yeah. So,
like a poor man's Vaporfly or Alpha Fly.
Do you wear the Vaporfly 4%?
I wore them at Spartathlon in 2019. I think they're okay. I had to make some modifications to them during the race because they were causing blisters on my heel, which is something you don't want. You know, I'd ran marathons and I think a 100K in them, in the same pair. And when it got to Spartathlon, they just felt completely different right from the start. I don't know why, but I'm a big fan of the first Vaporflies, the first edition. If I could get more of them, I'd... At the end of the day, they're just shoes. I think once you're in a race, like a really long ultra marathon, you know, comfort is probably more important than anything else, than, you know, carbon plate. I don't think your style of running is, you know, your gait and your economy is going to go out the window. So whether that carbon plate is going to do much for you in the last half of the race, I don't know. I don't know if it's going to do much.
Superb. Have you not been tempted to, have you ever tried any of the Hokas, which perhaps a bit more popular at Spartathlon, aren't they?
Yeah, I think they're okay. Yeah. I've got a couple. No, I've got a few pairs.
Tell your coach, Al.
Yeah, I've got a few pairs of Cliftons, which I don't like, so I haven't ran in them much. I've got a pair of them.
They're absolute pony, mate. Just bin them.
Hoka Mac, I have a pair of them, which I actually do use for really easy recovery runs. And if my feet are particularly sore, if I have a blister or whatever, I'll use them because they're so comfortable.
I bought a pair of the new Nike Invincible this week. Man, they are rubbish.
That's
worst Nike shoe on my feet for years. It's, oh man, it's bad. It looks awful. It's got this ridiculous clunky bit at the back. Man, not nice. Wasn't happy.
I have no clue about shoes, really. I don't know what's out there. I've heard good things about the Saucony Endorphin.
Yes.
Pro, is it? Or something like that. I've heard they're good if you like the carbon plate ones, but I have no clue. Like, I just find something that works for me and then stick with it. Unless if someone wants to give me a free pair of shoes, I'll try them out.
And now, an advert from our sponsor, Mimo.
Looking to buy a new pair of running shoes? Mimo helps runners like you to find the right shoes. All you have to do is put the Mimo sensor on your foot and run. That's it. We'll do the rest. Mimo will measure your running gait and our artificial intelligence algorithm will match your running style to all the latest shoes. Plus, you can access lots of running videos and content all within the Mimo app too. So, let Mimo find the right shoes for you. To find out more, visit www.mimo.co.uk.
I wanted to ask you about some of the shorter stuff, Al. So, actually, some of the shorter stuff and your thoughts about some of the longer stuff. So you've run fairly recently, right? You selected for Scotland to run in a Scotland vest at 100K, I think in Perth last year. Yeah. Year before last, 2019.
We've missed a year.
I know. Yeah, the year that would never go away, right? How was that running for your for your country in Perth. That must have been pretty special.
Incredible. Huh? Yeah, it was incredible. It was more than I expected in terms of. I've got goosebumps now just thinking about it because I'm not one of these people who's particularly come on Scotland or come on United Kingdom or anything like that.
Or Ireland.
Yeah. Well, that's another conversation. who knows what will happen in the future. Obviously, I've always wanted to run for Scotland, and it was an incredible experience. But the most rewarding thing, apart from the actual race itself, was actually just being part of a team, which is similar in part to the British Spartathlon team experience, where you get there and you start talking to people, and even the kind of build up for the Anglo-Celtic plate was really professional, and it really opened my eyes. And the preparation for a race and for the team for a race like that was pretty amazing. We were all allocated helpers for each runner who was passing them drinks and whatever they needed. I never used crew, so that was pretty amazing. But we were asked if we wanted to to submit timing sheets as well, so predicted time goals and pace sheets, which actually really focused my mind on the race and how it was going to pan out. I know our friend Bob Hearn does things like that for pretty much every race, but it's something I never usually do, but it really kind of made me focus on the race and, not getting drawn into battles with people at the start, because the pace was insane.
I can imagine.
For a stacked field with 100K runners, and three of them ended up doing sub 7 hours, which is just insane. I was a good half hour or more behind them. But there you go. That was, it was a PB for me. I'd actually only raced 100K once before, and that was a DNF. So I was always going to get a PB.
it's a tough distance to race, isn't it?
It's really in an area which is uncomfortable pace wise.
Yeah, absolutely.
Certainly once you get into sort of 60, 70, 80K, that's where it really hurts. And it's a really hard one to get through with your pace and where your head is at, because 100 mile races, you can relax and just get into the rhythm. But 100K, even right from the start, is you're always pushing yourself. You're always trying to keep the pace where it is, where your body and your legs are trying to hold you back. For me, anyway, being used to the longer stuff.
I think you could console yourself a little bit by the winner of that race, Charlie Harper, is 17 years younger.
Yeah, so. Thanks for that. He's an amazing runner, though.
He's amazing, isn't he? Yeah.
Such a nice guy. Which is when you meet these people and you're like, oh, they're so good. They're so good. And it's like, oh, they're nice people as well. Damn them. You really want these people who beat you to not be pleasant people, so you can spread lies about them or, rumors. But everyone I've competed against have been amazing people. Yeah,
that's great. Ultra running in the ultra running scene in Scotland is one of the things that's making me, being a Londoner, I actually get a bit homesick for Scotland when I look at what's going on there, because there's quite a strong scene in Scotland, isn't there?
Me too. And even just getting to race some of the races there, I've never, other than the race in Perth, the Anglo-Celtic Plate, I haven't raced in Scotland, and I'd love to do West Highland Way, Speyside Way Ultra.
Yeah,
it was one of Don Ritchie's old race. And Kyle Gregg from the Scottish team is a race director for that now.
Oh, is he really? Oh, fantastic.
So I'd love to do some of them. Yeah, those would be my top two Scottish races to look at if we were ever to get there. But I made friends with everyone on that team, and they're all great people, all the Scottish guys and the Scottish girls as well. You had Debbie on one of your episodes, didn't you? She was our team manager.
Yeah, Debbie's a team manager, yeah. Yeah, so I think, is it safe to say that the management of the Scotland 100K team is more professional than the management of the British Spartathlon team?
No, that's not. Well, the management of the British Spartathlon team have a tougher task, because they have to bring in a bit of money somehow, They don't get funding.
Somehow put their names on shirts, yeah.
Yeah.
So on the flip side of the 100K and the Spartathlon stuff then, I mean, obviously the crazy world of ultra running goes on and on and on and bloody on, doesn't it? So you mentioned briefly 24-hour which I presume you've still got a target for. But do you see yourself kind of going on beyond, like, this distance wise, like up to sort of 4-8 hour, 6 day, or like, you know, running across countries, kind of that kind of thing? Or do you think you've found your niche?
I've got a couple of things I'd like to do. Like, I haven't done a proper, I haven't achieved a proper 24-hour result that reflects where I'm at for various reasons. And I would like to give 48 hours a go. I can't see myself doing 6 days at the moment. Mainly because I wouldn't be allowed to do it with the family and everything, you know. it's just too long to be away. And I do have a yearning to do an FKT, but it's one of the bigger ones. We'll see how things pan out.
I think you'd be amazing at 4-8 hour, dude.
I would love to give it a try. Yeah, I think that's really, you imagine going into your second day of constant running, it'd be pretty mental. Yeah.
How's this year looking now? I mean, is it all every focus around Spartathlon? Have you got other races lined up?
Yeah, I've got 3 races lined up, one of which I haven't signed up for, but that's Belfast 24 hours. So
yeah,
it's kind of wait and see with that one. I'm not even sure you can actually register for it. Yeah, obviously I'm doing Spartathlon. I'm down to do Thames Path 100, but yay, that's probably not going to happen the way things are in Ireland. I don't think I'll be able to travel even then.
Okay.
Yeah, which is early May. There's lots of other ones I'd consider doing. If I can't do the Thames Path 100 and it happens, then there's one called the Morris Mullins Ultra in Ireland, which is the oldest race in Ireland, and it's a mountain race, so, you know, it's up and down quite a bit. I'd love to get into this trail running a bit more. Maybe not so much this year, but next year would be good. And then towards the end of the year, if, you know, if Belfast doesn't work out, then maybe one of the other 24-hour races, something like Barcelona. But it's been so hard, you know yourself. It's such a difficult time to anticipate what races are going to go ahead and figure out if you can travel to them.
It's very difficult, isn't it?
I'm kind of pretty confident it's going to happen this year. Yeah. And it will be amazing to get there and see everyone. Mm-hmm. And as much as the race itself, I just really enjoy the build-up to it all, and, you know, hanging out, meeting people at breakfast and talking to them and stuff like that. It's great. Yeah, fingers crossed. Hope it happens.
And how's the whiskey business, dude?
Yeah, it's good. I'm about to start a podcast myself through my work.
Yeah, so cool.
But yeah, whiskey is still booming. There's a lot of talk about it possibly being on the cusp of a crash, because in Ireland it's gone insane. When I started working, there were 3 distilleries here. Now there's, I think, something like 40 distilleries making whiskey.
Wow.
And the same thing's happened in other countries, even in England. Yeah, I think England has something like 30 distilleries now, mostly making gin.
Really? Whiskey in England?
Yeah. But yeah, there's a danger of overproduction, but that happens all the time, you know, cycles and things.
Are you a whiskey drinker, Daz?
Only in winter, mate, not when the sun's shining outside. Were you a bit devastated by the Daft Punk breakup, Al? They're one of your bands?
I wasn't really, because a lot of people would shoot me for saying this, but I wasn't a huge fan of their last album, even though it was their biggest commercial success. And they haven't done anything for 8 years, you know, it's not a surprise. But certainly their earlier stuff would have been a big influence on what I did in music. Not so much me, but the guys I hung out with, you know, made music with. But yeah, they picked a good time to retire, didn't they? There's nothing happening in music.
There's nothing happening, yeah, exactly. What was the name of your band?
Le Galaxy.
Le Galaxy.
With Galaxy, okay, spelt the French way, and the le being incorrect gender as well. So that caused a lot of confusion. But we did all right. We had some success in Ireland anyway.
Oh, wow. Okay. We'll need to check. Are you on Spotify?
Yeah, you'll find us there.
Still making music, Al?
No, I'm not, unfortunately. I'd love to have a drum room and be able to play the drums. Oh, I'm still playing guitar, you know. I kind of sit down at night and play a bit of guitar, but just for my own enjoyment.
You could form a super group with James Stewart.
Yeah, I've seen he's been picking up his guitar and playing cult songs, yeah.
You know, Daz is a budding guitarist too.
Oh, yeah? There's too many guitarists. That's the problem, you know. You should all take up the drums, because you'll get a gig, no problem.
Need a drummer.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. You need a drummer to hold it together, don't you? Without that, you're stuffed.
Nah, I would discourage anyone from playing the drums because you can't practice, you can't move them around. They cost too much, you know.
Al, Nathan pays me 100 euros every time I mention his name on a podcast.
Oh, yeah. Very good.
Doesn't he have in the head-to-head record? Isn't he slightly ahead of you in the head-to-head record?
I don't know, is he? I'll have to think about that.
In the early days, was it Robin Hood or what was the...
Robin Hood 100. We didn't actually meet until the end and I didn't know who I was running against. But that was my third 100 miler and I think it might have been his first or second. So we were both pretty green. And I hadn't run a 100 mile race until that year. So I'd done two before then, which is kind of crazy thinking. It's like 300 mile races within the space of 6 months. It was pretty intense. But yeah, we had a great battle in that race. We had, you know, it was back. Well, he was in the lead all the way. I sort of put that on the table. I never got past him, but I got close at one point.
You didn't run Flitchway the same year. You did different years, didn't you?
Yeah.
But you won Flitchway, didn't you?
Yeah, that was my last chance saloon, actually, to get a guaranteed place in 2018 for Spartathlon. And I got it. So, yeah, that was a nice race to win and get the time.
It's an iconic race. I've never done it. Have you done it once or twice, Daz?
What do you mean it's an iconic race? It's out of bloody railway line in Essex. There's nothing iconic about it.
In the middle of winter.
Yeah. I love how you romanticize shit like this in your head, David.
Someone's got it.
It's got two big climbs, two big railway bridges. Well, one's a railway, one's a motorway bridge or something like that. Yeah, 5 meter climbs and then you're on the flat again. And it's featureless. It's in the middle of winter. It's muddy. It's freezing. But yeah, it's iconic.
True ultra. That's magical. I was romanticizing about it, Daz. I was very close trying to do it this year, but obviously races are still getting cancelled, aren't they?
Well, I guess it's been cancelled for this year. But I'm slagging off, and I shouldn't. I don't mean any offence to Lindley, the organiser, because he does a great job. And actually, I mean, it is quite an incredible race in terms of the people that it attracts. So there's usually only a handful of finishers, maybe 15 finishers or something. But I'll just read out from 2018, the year Al won it. So Al won in 7:55. And just a minute, just 2 minutes behind, is a chap called Peter Vermeesch, who's a fantastic runner. He's a Belgian fella who lives in London, runs for Clapham Chasers, and he's had all kinds of epic ultra performances. So to see him there was pretty cool. And then in third place was our dear friend Mr. Ian Hammett. Yeah. So you know that's an amazing podium. For such a small kind of random race in Essex, and then you've got people like Izzy, I'm getting mixed up. I thought that was Izzy Wikes. It's not Izzy Wikes. There's a guy called Stefan Matthew who came in fifth, and he's run.
Right. He's doing Spartathlon this year, isn't he?
He is in the field for Spartathlon. Yeah. But if you look,
yeah, I knew the name and I saw it down.
He's prolific at 100Ks. He's run. I don't know how many of them he's run. But if you check his DEV record, he has been everywhere to run 100Ks. He's a bit of a 100K specialist. He's a lovely fella. And great to see him in the Sparsa field. So yeah, it's a cool race. I mean, so David, there you go. It's got your name on it, mate.
Next year.
obviously, they have to change the format. I think he is changing the format of the length, isn't he? Is he making it 100 miles to make sure it's... an official qualifying distance, yeah, because you can't do 100K exactly. As your Spartathlon qualifier anymore.
I know, it's just too short. It's too short.
So when's your next Anto Lee race, Al?
I can't really talk about that because there's something possibly happening in August that might be related to an inter-country ultra event that might be 100Ks or something like that. But I've said too much already. No, a little birdie tells me that there might be something happening in August in Ireland, and I might be doing that. But his 50K Irish Championships are obviously cancelled because they would have been last week here. It's the kind of time of year he runs a 50K championship, so it's not happening until later in the year, also in August, same race. So
yeah, it's looking like it could be a good summer. Yeah. Let's hope that Boris has promised to open the nightclubs, and hopefully we can all race and celebrate. So
I hope so. Yeah.
Cool, man. It's been great chatting with you, Al. That's absolutely brilliant.
It has, yeah. It's great to talk about, you know, if we can't run races, to talk about them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Goodness gracious me.
Doctor, I'm in trouble. Well, goodness gracious me.